the labor hour people to Radio Free Labor people to go over, because I'm going to go to the rally and I'll try to set up some equipment and document the rally, hopefully. And last week's Counterspin, which we don't air, it alternates now with Higher Ground, the Ammons show, was Nancy Altman on Social Security attacks. And looks like a good rundown, Nancy Altman. There's a quick look at media coverage of Mahu Khalil. That is indeed what the main focus of the rally was about on Monday last. Seems like a longer than that ago. But let's kick it with Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier essay. Just checked, Mumia doesn't have anything new up. There's some interesting other prisoners making comments. I've always talked about putting a few of those on. Some of them are very specific and very plaintive. But maybe another day. Oh, let's do an underwriting announcement from the Park District here at the top of the hour, too. Come to think of it, might be a good idea to get that in.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and the Champaign Park District. Looking for something fun to do this weekend? The Champaign Park District's Weekend Explorer email comes out every Thursday, jam-packed with ideas, events, and programs for each upcoming weekend. Information on subscribing to the Weekend Explorer can be found at champaignparks.org.
Okay. Nothing about the signal crisis, except WEF's signal crisis. We're at 100%. I haven't checked just now, but looks like we're doing really well, and the power coming back from the antenna is way low, way low. We were upper limit through that stretch. Thanks to everybody that helped in that. There is still a piece of equipment to go in the broadcast chain that might improve the signal even further. We'll see when that gets installed. And, yeah. I heard a little chatter. It seemed to be not as obnoxious as sometimes it has been. And right now it's clear signal time. So opinions you hear here are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And Amy's got a piece on journalism in the Gaza too, I think, here. It's all grim, but we need to look at it at least part of the time.
If you're reading this, it means I've been killed. Palestinian journalists and Israel's crosshairs. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. If you're reading this, it means I've been killed, most likely targeted by the Israeli occupation forces. These words, written by 23-year-old Palestinian journalist Hassam Shabbat, who worked for Al Jazeera and Dropsite News, were posted online by friends after he was killed in an Israeli airstrike on March 24th. That same day, Hassam posted on Instagram that Mohammed Mansour, a reporter for Palestine Today TV, was killed by an Israeli airstrike. An hour later, Hassam himself was killed. He and Mansour are just the latest of over 200 journalists and media workers killed in the Gaza Strip since Israel began its assault on October 7, 2023. Sharif Abdelkaddous, a journalist with Dropsite News, who's reported from Gaza, now edits and translates Dropsite's correspondence there as Israel's blocked foreign reporters from entering. Sharif recently returned from London, where his latest Gaza documentary for Al Jazeera English, The Night Won't End, won the Royal Television Society Award. The documentary, which relied on Gaza-based Palestinian videographers, also won the coveted Overseas Press Club Award here in the United States. Sharif was in the process of editing a piece from Hassam Shabbat when he learned of his death.
We have to be very clear, Hassam was deliberately killed,
Sharif said on the Democracy Now! News Hour.
He was assassinated by the Israeli military. The Israeli military has openly admitted to this. They call him a terrorist, and they said, quote, "Don't let the press vest fool you."
Sharif shared the 2022 George Polk Award for the documentary The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, about Israel's killing of the renowned Palestinian-American Al Jazeera journalist in the occupied West Bank, May 11, 2022. The Polk Award is named after a U.S. journalist summarily executed while reporting on the Greek Civil War in 1948. Violence against journalists is not new. In the case of Polk and Abu Akleh, as with so many others, journalists are killed by U.S.-backed and armed regimes. Israel's targeting of journalists in Gaza, however, has taken this violence to a new, unprecedented scale.
Israel has a long history of killing journalists, especially Palestinian journalists, with impunity.
Sharif Abdelkaddous continued.
Hossam and five other journalists in October were placed on essentially a hit list by the Israeli military.
Hossam received numerous death threats via phone and text. A reporter asked him if he would continue reporting. Hossam replied,
"There are massacres and bombings, so we must continue covering and spreading the truth. The Israeli occupation is determined to chase down journalists, to prevent the exposure of their crimes."
Hossam's final article, posted posthumously at Dropsite News, provides a graphic depiction of Israel's renewed bombardment of Gaza after abandoning the short-lived ceasefire. He wrote, "As the bombs rain down, the wails of neighbors announced the first moments of the resumption of Israel's military campaign. Beit Hanun was plunged into panic and terror. Cries of distress rose amidst the screech of the shells in a scene that reflected the magnitude of the disaster engulfing the city. This was only the beginning. The massacre of entire families quickly followed," unquote. In his self-written epitaph, Hossam Shabbat wrote, "For the past 18 months, I've dedicated every moment of my life to my people. I documented the horrors in northern Gaza minute by minute, determined to show the world the truth they tried to bury. I slept on pavement, in schools, in tents, anywhere I could. Each day was a battle for survival. I endured hunger for months, yet I never left my people's side," he wrote. Now he's joined Gaza's dead, over 50,000 killed by the Israeli military since October 2023. That number is widely believed to be a vast undercount, as many bodies remain beneath the rubble. Most of what we know of the ongoing suffering in Gaza comes from Palestinian journalists who remain alive. Among them is 22-year-old Abu Bakr Abed. After Hossam's death, he spoke on Democracy Now! From Deir al-Balah in Gaza, where he's been diagnosed with malnutrition, his whole body aching.
"We are facing death in every single direction, from the starvation, from the relentless bombardments, and from the conditions that we are living under. So it's a very, very horrific situation. As long as Israel, the world allows Israel to do so, this will not stop. We need more people to come out in the streets, to close the roads, and to go on global strikes to make sure that this can be lifted, that this blockade and this aggression can be stopped."
Expressions of solidarity with Palestinians in the U.S. under President Donald Trump's administration are being met with intimidation, arrests, and for foreign students, threats of deportation. The targeting of dissenters, like the targeting of journalists, as well as the U.S.-backed Israeli occupation of Palestine, must end. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
I hadn't actually heard the substance of that. I didn't know it was somebody who was working with Drop Zone. Okay, I said I wasn't going to say much about the, or anything about the, this whole signal crisis. I have a segment about Yemen from a historical perspective. Oil. Oil. It's not just about oil, but it's mostly about oil. Saudis need the reserves in South Yemen because they lied about how much they really have in their own territory. They've de facto had a part of Yemen for quite a while. But you might Google different spanks for different ranks. I found a military.com article. There's a lot of anger in the military ranks against Hegseth not being reprimanded. So there you go. I'm glad if you heard the tail end of the fair counterspin report, you heard the chapter and verse on the latest neocon who's now a hero because he's anti-Trump. It takes more than anti-Trump to be a hero. I mean, a coalition should include some people you're uncomfortable with, but you should go into it with open eyes. The business about him being an IDF person. I watched him on Washington Bleak and Review, which is what I call it, last night. He's been hosting it for a while. It's gotten worse than it was, which kind of is bleak. But he didn't offer how Michael Waltz had his contact list. They had been signaling to each other in the past. Maybe it goes back to when he was advocating for the attack on Iraq and justifying it after the fact. Amazing. So, yeah. All right, here's Jessica Greenberg. This is from What's Up on Facebook, so you can find it there on my Facebook page. So I've got better audio from a camcorder and also another recorder, but this was expedient. I didn't get it. She's talking about the correspondence between the Faculty for Justice in Palestine, which was one of the convening groups for the Monday rally on Mahmoud Khalil's case, and then broader issues of academic freedom. There's a great testimony by a representative from UC Jews for Ceasefire that I'll play. There's also a reading by two different people, one Palestinian, one Jewish American, of Khalil's letter from jail. Now, if you heard Democracy Now! Yesterday, which I haven't heard but three out of the five this week, it's hard sometimes. I do look through the listings and read the text sometimes. But, so you heard Mahmoud Khalil in his own voice, because there's this new film out called Encampment, that was discussed at length, and they played some outtakes of it. And as he was a major spokesperson and interlocutor with the university, and is quite articulate, he was included in that film. So without further ado, here's from the South Patio of the Quad last Monday. Again, I have three segments, and then about 28 minutes of undercurrents. I'm going to leave early from the show so I can get to the rally site. Again, courthouse in Urbana. I assume it's the county courthouse and not because I think it's on a Main Street address, but it's either the federal or the county courthouse. The county courthouse has a larger pavilion, so hopefully there'll be a lot of people there, despite the weather. Again, this is Jessica Greenberg. I just manipulated the video from the camcorder, and this in its entirety will be up at the IMC YouTube page, hopefully within a week. I don't know. We'll see.
On the mission of this public institution, and we also call on the university to make real academic freedom, freedom of expression, freedom of conscience, not just for all of us, but those already facing disciplinary proceedings, criminal charges, and potentially federal charges and imprisonment for actions that were to defend all of our freedoms here on campus and in here on campus, that until we are all free, nobody is free. Woo! And we from a much, much longer history of struggle, that until there is justice in Palestine, there is no justice. Woo!
I'm from Jews for Ceasefire. Sorry, can you hear me?
No.
Okay,
Hello? Okay.
I thank my community for trusting me to speak, and I hope to honor that trust. Our friends, families, classmates, and colleagues are being targeted in the name of Jewish safety. This twisted logic cannot fool us. We know it's not about Jewish safety, it's about maintaining corrupted power. Wow. Project Esther was made by the same think tank that's behind Project 2025. They say we are agents of Hamas, that we are un-American, and that we must be stopped by any means. What are those means? They're deporting people based on old laws originally created by anti-Semites to restrict the number of Jewish immigrants escaping the Holocaust. They are trying to scare us into submission, and it will not work. We will not concede our power to fascists. And yet, we must keep each other safe in the fight. We all have risks to consider. There's no shame in being strategic. Whether you're facing prosecution from last year's encampment, because of your migrant status or some other issue of accessibility, if you cannot join us in the streets of protest, know that you are always welcome in our meetings, in our homes, in our rituals, in our families. You are part of our community even if you need to keep a low profile. Whether you are ready to take on more risk or take a step back, we are here for you. We cannot be divided by their scare tactics. When I think of my family seeking refuge in generations past, I wonder what it would have meant to be received by this country with curiosity and kindness and protection. What intergenerational traumas could have been mended? My father is heartbroken to admit that as a kid, him and his cousins used to make fun of their grandmother's accent and her funny smelling foods and her broken English. They were taught the only way to belong here in the new country is to abandon and be ashamed of their own culture, that the only way to survive was to keep your head down and assimilate. It is our obligation now to heal these wounds.
Yes.
It is an act of rebellion to wrestle with injustice and cultivate a sense of place with our neighbors.
Yes.
I offer these blessings. May every child live to be proud of their grandparents. May Mahmoud Khalil be released to witness the birth of his child. May the prosecution be released from their legal burdens. May every migrant be safe to live their lives whole and messy and human without fear of arrest and deportation. May our academic institutions support us in voicing our stories and fighting for justice. And may we live to see the violent Israeli apartheid dismantled and the liberation of a free Palestine. Blessed are the divine powers which have kept us alive and brought us to this moment. We keep us safe.
Again, that's from the rally on Monday, and I heard her name on one of the two segments that I just played, and went one in one ear and out the other. She's a representative from CU Jews for Ceasefire. Again, there's a rally at the courthouse in Urbana. I believe that will be the county courthouse on the patio on Main Street. Don't have the details in front of me. Check your local listings. It's at 11 o'clock, though, so I'm leaving early. And let's see how the time looks. I guess I won't be playing Issa Blumi on Yemen. Maybe I'll do that tomorrow. Have a nice segment that talks about George Herbert Walker's oil firm's involvement in Yemen historically. So here is two people from the rally, Stuart Levy, and I didn't catch the name of the second person who eventually eschewed the bullhorn. There was problems with the bullhorn. When I used to go to rallies in the day, on the quad, the Illini Union provided a microphone and a cord, and you would use this built-in sound system, but they're not so amenable. There was a very nice sound system brought to the rally, but it was not allowed to be used. I guess the I-team said, nope, nope. I-team was there. The I-team is monitoring. So I guess they were recording. I sent a copy of the audio of the record of the rally to our sibling station, WILL, right, Illinois Public Media. I don't know if they'll have one of their interns listen to it just to see what they missed, since there was no media at... I'll be right back with you. So here is Mahmoud Khalil's letter from the jail, again, from reading at the U of I patio, south patio, on Monday.
Cold mornings and spend long days bearing witness to the quiet injustices underway against a great many people precluded from the protections of the law. Who has the right to have rights? It is certainly not the humans crowded into the cells here. It isn't the Senegalese man I met, who's been deprived of his liberty for a year, his legal situation in limbo, and his family an ocean away. It isn't the 21-year-old detainee I met, who stepped foot in this country at age 9, only to be deported without so much as a hearing. Justice escapes the contours of this nation's immigration facilities. On March 8th, I was taken by DHS agents who refused to provide a warrant and accosted my wife and me as we returned from dinner. By now, the footage of that night has been made public. Before I knew what was happening, agents handcuffed and forced me into an armed, unmarked car. At that moment, my only concern was for Noor's safety. I had no idea if she would be taken too, since the agents had threatened to arrest her for not leaving my side. DHS would not tell me anything for hours. I did not know the cause of my arrest or if I was facing immediate deportation. At 26 Federal Plaza, I slept on the cold floor. In early morning hours, agents transported me to another facility in Elizabeth, New Jersey. There I slept on the ground and was refused a blanket despite my request. My arrest was a direct consequence of exercising my right to free speech as I advocated for a free Palestine and an end to the genocide in Gaza, which resumed in full force Monday night. With January's ceasefire now broken, parents in Gaza are once again cradling two small shrouds, and families are forced to weigh starvation and displacement against bombs. It is our moral imperative to persist in the struggle for their complete freedom. I was born in a Palestinian refugee camp in Syria to a family which has been displaced from their land since the 1948 Nakba. I spent my youth in proximity to, yet distant from, my homeland. But being Palestinian is an experience that transcends borders. I see in my circumstances similarities to Israel's use of administrative detention, imprisonment without trial or charge, to strip Palestinians of their rights.
I think of our friend, Omar Khatib, who was incarcerated without charge or trial by Israel as he returned home from travel. I think of Gaza Hospital Director and Pediatrician, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, who was taken captive by the Israeli military on December 27th and remains in an Israeli torture camp today. For Palestinians, imprisonment without due process is commonplace. I have always believed that my duty is not only to liberate myself from oppressors, but also to liberate my oppressors from their hatred and fear. Yeah. My unjust detention is indicative of the anti-Palestinian racism that both the Biden and Trump
administrations have demonstrated over the past 16 months as the U.S. has continued to supply Israel with weapons to kill Palestinians and prevent international intervention. For decades, anti-Palestinian racism has driven efforts to expand U.S. laws and practices that are used to violently repress Palestinians, Arab Americans, and other communities. Shame. This is precisely why I'm being targeted. While I await legal decisions that hold the futures of my wife and child in the balance, those who enabled my targeting remain comfortably at Columbia University. Yeah. President Shafiq Armstrong and Dean Yari Milo laid the groundwork for the U.S. government to target me by arbitrarily disciplining pro-Palestinian students and allowing viral doxing campaigns based on racism and disinformation to go unchecked. Columbia targeted me for my activism, creating a new authoritarian disciplinary office to bypass due process and silence students criticizing Israel. Columbia surrendered to federal pressure by disclosing student records to Congress and yielding to the Trump administration's latest threats. My arrest, expulsion, or suspension of at least 22 Columbia students, some stripped of their BA degrees just before graduation, and the expulsion of SWC President Grant Miner on the eve of contract negotiations are clear examples. If anything, my detention is a testament to the strength of the student movement and shifting public opinion toward Palestinian liberation. Students have long been at the forefront of change, leading the charge against the Vietnam War, standing on the front lines of the civil rights movement, and driving the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. Today, too, even if the public has yet to fully grasp it, it is students who steer us toward truth and justice. The Trump administration is targeting me as part of a broader strategy to suppress dissent. Visa holders, green card carriers, and citizens alike will all be targeted for their political beliefs. In the weeks ahead, students, advocates, and elected officials must unite to defend the right to protest for Palestine. At stake are not just our voices, but the fundamental civil liberties of all. Knowing fully that this moment transcends my individual circumstances, I hope, nonetheless, to be free to witness the birth of my firstborn child.
Okay, that's a rendering of the letter from the jail from Mahmoud Khalil, spoken at the Monday rally. And Speaking of rallies, I'm headed out to see what's going on the patio, the courthouse, Champaign County Courthouse at 11. I'm bringing some recording equipment. Still trying to find who the conveners are. I guess Champaign County Indivisible isn't one of them. I heard something about CUER, C-U-E-R, C-U-R-E. Sorry about this. As I mentioned, the yesterday's episode of Democracy Now! Had some Mahmoud Khalil in his own words. He's extremely articulate, and it's from the film Encampment they were talking about, which has just been released. Okay, I guess I should do some business. We are having the power to the tower donation. There's been a matching $10,000 ponied up, but if you can match that, we can get $20,000, which is kind of our goal. As of Friday at 9 a.m., we're at 5880, which is over halfway. Eric's down here, and maybe he's tallying up some numbers right now. Maybe the Radio Free Labor people will be able to pass on the current amount. This is specific for the tower. And, yeah. Law and Disorder Radio is what I'm going to play now. That'll fill out the hour, and hopefully we'll get it all on, and Radio Free Labor will take over. Opinions are those of the speakers. This is, again, from New York City, some left-wing lawyers. I don't know who's doing the interlocuting, whether it's Michael Smith, but it's about the executive orders, one after another. But it does have some material on Mahmoud Khalil as well. Most recent article by Michael Rode, who is the person being interviewed, main person in the conversation. Anyway, let's kick it off. Radio Free Labor coming up in a half hour or so.
No time in his second term attacking free speech and freedom of the press. He arrested Mahmoud Khalil, a permanent U.S. resident with a green card and a student visa, and is trying to deport him until restrained by a federal judge. Khalil's crime was leading pro-Palestinian protests at Columbia University. Trump has threatened to deport other students for their pro-Palestinian protests. Trump banned the Associated Press from the White House press briefings and Air Force One for using the term Gulf of Mexico instead of Gulf of America. He also banned Reuters News Service and Huffington Post from the press pool. He's issued executive orders, which federal agencies have cited as authority, to ban forbidden words from government websites, such as the words diversity, equity, and inclusion. He threatened to pull federal funding from over 50 universities for teaching aspects of American history, such as slavery and racism, which he labels divisive. He's encouraged congressional investigations against Democrats who served on the January 6th committee. And he's promoted a definition of anti-Semitism, which would punish political criticism of Israel. And he's filed lawsuits seeking hundreds of millions of dollars in damages against ABC, CBS, Media Matters for America, and newspapers, based on how they reported on him, his candidacy, and his actions as president. To help us assess Trump's attacks on the press, we're very pleased to have invited one of the preeminent First Amendment lawyers in the country to join us. James Goodall is the former vice president and general counsel for the New York Times and later the Times vice chairman. He is the author of Fighting for the Press, the inside story of the Pentagon Papers and other battles. Goodall represented the New York Times in four of its U.S. Supreme Court cases, including Brandsburg versus Hayes, in which the Times intervened on behalf of its reporter, Earl Caldwell. The other cases were New York Times versus Sullivan, New York Times versus the U.S., that's the Pentagon Papers case, and New York Times versus Tassini. He's been called the father of the reporter's privilege in the Hastings Law Journal because of his interpretation of the Brandsburg case. James Goodall, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Jim, on the very first day of his second term, Donald Trump issued an executive order defending freedom of speech. He declared that, quote, government censorship of speech is intolerable in a free society, unquote, and he announced that it is the policy of the United States to, quote, secure the right of the American people to engage in constitutionally protected speech, to ensure that no federal government officer, employee, or agent engages in or facilitates any conduct that would unconstitutionally abridge the free speech of any American citizen, and to, quote, ensure that no taxpayer resources are used to engage in or facilitate any conduct that would unconstitutionally abridge the free speech of any American citizen. It sounds like Trump is violating his own executive order. How much of a threat does Trump pose to the First Amendment?
I think to answer the thrust of your question, Trump poses a huge threat to the First Amendment, and we haven't seen all of it yet. With respect to the executive order, which you quoted, I think we should say to ourselves, that's just a bunch of Trump nonsense. One cannot believe what Trump says all the time. You have to take it into context and then try to figure out whether he's being serious or not. I think, with respect to the executive order, what he's talking about is reverse discrimination. In other words, he's laying the groundwork to say that the diversity programs that institutions have in this country do not fit his view of the First Amendment. Therefore, one should say when one hears that good-sounding phrases about the First Amendment, don't believe him. He's just setting you up for something else.
Jim, do you see any comparison between the Khalil case and the Red Scare of the 1950s? And also, could you tell us how the Red Scare influenced your view of the First Amendment?
I lived through the Red Scare, grew up in Cambridge, the home of Harvard, then a town very much like Berkeley. Today it's more suburban. And the Red Scare was a big part of my life, personally. I lost a grade school classmate who had just graduated from college. Our family lost two family friends to the Red Scare. By the word loss, I mean each of the lives of the three people to whom I've referred were immeasurably changed. Two lost their jobs, and one fled to Canada. So the history of the Red Scare, which is the McCarthy-driven desire to out people with respect to their associations with fellow travelers or even with communists, was a big part of my personal life. And I carried that with me. And therefore, as time went on and I became a general counsel of the New York Times, on or about the time, a little before, in fact, Nixon became president, I was immediately reminded of the Red Scare of McCarthy's time with respect to Nixon's behavior. And when Nixon was elected president in 1968, I was ready for him to attack the New York Times in every way that he could think of, including, number one, trying to get the sources of the Times, one of the Times' few black reporters, and then secondly, with respect to the Pentagon Papers. I looked at Nixon as effectively the reincarnation of Joseph McCarthy, who by the time of the events I've described had passed on to other things. Bottom line, huge influence.
Before we get to the Pentagon Papers case and your representation of the New York Times, let's talk about Trump's lawsuits against television networks. You have said it was cowardly of ABC to pay Trump $15 million to settle Trump's lawsuit, claiming he was defamed when George Stephanopoulos used the term rape instead of sexual abuse to describe the basis of a civil verdict against Trump. Tell us about that case, and are you concerned that settlements in these high-profile cases can set a dangerous precedent?
Well, I'm very much concerned that the settlement of a case like the ABC case establishes a precedent for Trump to beat up the press, because in that case, George Stephanopoulos said, in effect, substantially what was correct, colon, that Trump had raped a accuser in a department store in New York. In fact, the rape in question was what I would call digital rape, and not the rape with which one is ordinarily familiar. Thus, Stephanopoulos slipped a little bit in describing what happened, but the purpose of the First Amendment today, because of an ancient case called the Sullivan case, is to give people like Stephanopoulos breathing space to articulate events and not articulate them entirely correctly, as long as they're substantially correct and there is no intention to lie. The First Amendment, the Sullivan case said, protects Stephanopoulos. So if you pull that case apart, as I have, there was no need whatsoever for ABC to settle the case, because if they had continued on, it was settled halfway through, if they continued on, they would have won. And it's quite clear they would have won. So why in the world, if you are a winner, would you pay somebody $15 or $16 million to go away? There's no reason for it other than to please Trump. And that is what ABC wanted to do. They wanted to have a good relationship with Trump, so they pay him the money.
You were a lawyer in New York Times against Sullivan, decided in 1964. What's the importance of that case? Several Supreme Court justices want to overturn Sullivan. Why is it important to freedom of the press to this day?
The Sullivan case was a case brought in Alabama by Mr. Sullivan, who was a county commissioner, against the New York Times for running an ad which was not entirely correct. In other words, it's very much like the Trump ABC situation. It had said, for example, the Sullivan's minions had surrounded the local establishment, driving fear into the inhabitants of it, when in fact that did not happen. And the Supreme Court said, when you have public events involving public officials, you do not have to be precisely correct, thus overturning a decision against the New York Times, which then was the amount of $500,000, but you have to multiply it by inflation rate today. And when one added up all of the similar cases brought against the press in Alabama, and particularly the New York Times, you could only come to the conclusion the New York Times would be put out of business. So the case stands for when you have a public event with a public official and you don't report it 100% correctly, you are protected. And the reason you need the protection is because otherwise, under the circumstances, you can be put out of business. Now, there are several justices on the Supreme Court that says that's too much leeway, and we want to go back to the time immemorial, I might say, under what is known as the common law, where you did not have that extra protection to make a mistake. You have to be absolutely or substantially accurate. The justices who opposed the Solomon case today on the Supreme Court say. So the risk that is present with Trump around is that a case may in fact end up before the Supreme Court, and perhaps you'd get five justices who want to overturn it. I think that's not going to happen, but that is the fear.
Jim, there's another television network case. Trump is suing CBS, alleging, quote, consumer fraud over an interview with Kamala Harris broadcast during the 2024 presidential election. A complaint has also been filed with the FCC over that broadcast. And you've called the lawsuit a bunch of nonsense and said, quote, Trump's legal theory doesn't exist anywhere in the law. You've said it would be an absolute disaster for the press if CBS settled that case. Please tell our listeners what CBS did and the grounds that Trump is alleging and why you believe CBS should fight the case in court.
What CBS did was they did an interview with Kamala Harris, and they showed it twice. They showed it in the morning as part of the morning cycle on Sunday, and then they showed it Sunday night. But the episodes they used were not exactly the same. CBS edited the second showing of the Kamala Harris interview, and Trump has said that CBS does not have the right to edit its stories the way it did. And by so editing it, it damaged Trump. That's the first thing that Trump said. And then the second thing he said was, well, I'm going to sue CBS for misleading the public. That's the way the public gets misled when it buys phony goods, because it, CBS, did not tell everybody that it was editing the two excerpts to which I've referred. And this is the case that has been brought against CBS in Texas. It's a bunch of nonsense because every writer edits. There is nobody who just can write perfectly from beginning to end, at least in the normal course. And so, if in fact Trump can complain about what the broadcast did from an editing point, and then secondly, sue for misleading the public without telling what it's edited, there goes the First Amendment protection that all writers have to think, change, write, use different tenses, all the things creative people do would be not protected by the First Amendment, and you could sue them for changes that they made. Now, if you add it up, that would mean that every article you read, or almost every article you read, in all probability, on the internet, in the print paper, has been edited, which means that under this rule that Trump has come up, every single piece of writing in America would be subject to a lawsuit unless the writer disclosed that he'd edited a word, changed a syllable, forgot to cross a T, and that sort of thing. So the idea that all of the above, which is part of the normal, as journalists say, creative process, can be subject to lawsuits, in my humble view, is a bunch of nonsense.
This is Steve Rohde, and I'm joined by Heidi Boghossian as co-host on Law and Disorder. Today's guest is James Goodall, a preeminent First Amendment lawyer. Jim, you've practiced law in New York City for 66 years and have witnessed how Donald Trump has weaponized litigation against the media. Tell us what you saw and whether there is a method to Trump's madness.
Well, this goes back to the way I characterize Trump. He has weaponized the court system in New York to create the appearance that he'll sue anybody for anything. And to tell the truth, during the pre-presidential years, no one paid much attention to him, because what he would do is, if somebody had written an article about him that wasn't absolutely highly reverential, he would sue them. For example, the Time magazine published an article in which they said, Donald Trump, comma, a millionaire hotel owner, womp, a suit is brought against Time magazine because he said he wasn't a millionaire, he was a billionaire. And you can say to yourself, that sounds pretty funny. But in the meantime, Time Inc. has to defend the suit, has to pay lawyers to make it go away. And it is typical, accordingly, of what Trump did to weaponize the law and litigation as an ordinary course of his commercial existence in New York City. And he would sue anybody for anything. I mean, his lawyer must have had over 100 lawsuits of the kind that I've just described. So you had to be careful if you're doing business with him, because if something went off the tracks, you could add the legal expenses of getting rid of a silly lawsuit to whatever transaction you're doing with him.
Jim, you represented the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case. Please remind our listeners what was at stake in that case and how the Times and the Washington Post fought back, and then what did the Supreme Court decide?
In the Pentagon Papers case, the New York Times published a secret, classified, top secret history of the Vietnam War. After it published several times, the United States government came in to stop the publication by getting a court order saying that the publication would damage national security. That's got a fancy name called prior restraint, which I don't like, but that's what it's called. The case proceeded for several days. In that interim, the United States government also sued the Washington Post, and both papers were initially enjoined, and then there was a split in what the courts did as to each of the papers. Now, why, first of all, before telling you what happened in the long run, is the principle that I've of stopping publication important? It speaks for itself. If you can't publish without being stopped by the government, it's very much the same as having a censorship system whereby you have to ask the government if it's okay to publish this or that. I don't think I should take a lot of time to explain that we do not have a censorship system in this country, and we certainly don't have a system which is the first cousin of it, in which a judge can come in and stop publication. For me, it was very simple that the government had no power to do anything with respect to the publication of the New York Times. If the government wanted to do something, it could bring what is known as a criminal action. It could prosecute the Times. But you can't stop something from coming out before it's coming out. It makes no sense because, among other things, you don't know exactly what people are going to publish. The case has become more and more important as time has gone on because in it the Supreme Court decided that what I said is pretty much the basis of the fundamental basis of the First Amendment and came up with a decision that I don't think will ever be overturned, which says that you can't get a prior restraint. You can't stop the press from publishing before it's publishing, even if it's national security. There could be exceptions, let's say for the atomic bomb or the hydrogen bomb during wartime, but those exceptions are so perverse that they're not really relevant to the ordinary course of what publications do. So the decision has become enshrined in First Amendment law. Lawyers like to say jurisprudence, but that's a little too fancy. It's the decision, lastly, which gave birth to a whole movement of First Amendment thinking, cases, and so forth and so on, that took place in the 3 or 4 decades following that decision, which was back in 1971.
Jim, you've said the response of the press as we speak has been pathetic in terms of what Trump is doing. Tell us why you feel that way, and also what can we expect eventually from the U.S. Supreme Court?
We have a press that's quite different, obviously, than it was 40 years ago when we had the Pentagon Papers case and everybody rushed to the side of the New York Times. We have people in the press like Musk who really don't understand what the press is doing, or in Facebook. And it's very hard to look for that multifaceted group for a leader to fight against Trump. And as a consequence, the response to the various items we've been talking about today has been sporadic and needs to be improved. The press needs somebody to stand up to Trump, assuming that eventually someone will be found to stand up against Trump. And I think there will be groups that do that. Does it make any difference? Because if you go to the Supreme Court, you're going to a Trump court, and are you going to lose? I am modestly optimistic that the First Amendment isn't going to be fully destroyed by the Trump court, even though it's in its majority. I think it's reasonable to expect that around the edges there may be some problems. But I think that First Amendment jurisprudence, let's say the decisions by the Supreme Court about the First Amendment over the last 40 years are so fundamental that I think the fundamental thrust of the First Amendment will remain, even though Trump will try to destroy it.
Jim, we are so grateful for what you've done personally to defend the First Amendment throughout your career. Thank you for joining us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
I think we'll leave it right there. Here's a little underwriting announcement for you folks out there. Thanks for tuning in, WEFT Champaign. Back on the airwaves, full power. It's been a while. Thanks. Oops.
Ash Pepper Roofing offers roofing and re-roofing, gutters, siding, and door needs. For more information, 217-352-2200 or online at bashpepper.com.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and